Hello and welcome to Bayou to Beltway. Our guest today is City Parish Mayor President Joel Robideau, head of Lafayette Consolidated Government. Mr. Robideau was born in Lake Charles. He went to Fatima High School. He was a UL Lafayette grad in finance, went to LSU, got a master's in finance, passed his CPA, worked for Texas Instruments, returned to Lafayette in 1990 and ran for office. I set a practice here, but ran for office, District 45. He was very successful, served three terms, ending as chairman of Ways and Means, and many people thought he was going to be speaker his last term, but didn't quite work out, but still he had a very powerful position there. He was perhaps the most influential person in the Louisiana House in his last term. And then after that, he ran for and was elected mayor president of Lafayette Consolidated Government in 2015, taking office in 2016. He's been in office about a year and a half, although it feels like 10 years. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's like dog years in during hurricane season, for sure.
Well, isn't that the truth? Why don't we just talk about hurricane season, since you mentioned that. Most areas of Acadiana weren't really badly hurt by Harvey. Lafayette, I don't think there was too much damage, but we certainly have some experience with storms. We had that punishing storm of last August, probably gave you a baptism in fire. Irma is hovering on the horizon. Where is Lafayette with preparation for the next big storm, flood, or disaster?
Yeah, we have our emergency operations center run by Craig Stansberry and Linda Laverne, and you know, behind the scenes, they're doing that stuff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year. It's not just when there's a hurricane, because there's all kinds of potential threats out there, especially in today's world. But but as it relates to the hurricanes, we get updates like now because of Irma. We'll have our 10:30, 4:30 every day. Those two conference calls with the governor's office, the Office of Homeland Security, GOSEP, at the Emergency Operations Center, all call in just to get the updated tracking, to understand what the timeline's looking like, and start making the preparations. There's a lot that goes on that, a lot of things need to be implemented and put in place just in case. And everybody kind of is on alert, has to be ready in the event. Certainly prior to any kind of landfall is when the folks at Public Works are kind of doubling down and trying to get as much done as they can. And a lot of that is even securing the work that's being done. They may be in the middle of a big coulee renovation, trying to get the walls redone. And so if we know there's a storm coming, we kind of have to batten down the hatches even on those projects and get all that done to where it doesn't make it worse. So a lot goes on, and now with Irma, we're starting the 10:30. Yesterday was the afternoon, was the first conference call, and then we'll be doing those every day now for the foreseeable future.
Amazing amount of preparation that takes for all this. The mayor of Houston was, there's been some speculation about not ordering an evacuation. Do you have any insight into that? Did he make the right decision? How would you base your decision about potentially evacuating the Lafayette City Parish area?
Yeah, so there's a balance, and so the balance is always on the safety of the citizens, and you you make your decisions as the elected official on which of my decisions is going to put the most people or get them out of harm's way. And so in yesterday's conversation, for instance, 120 hours is what you want for an evacuation. And so when we were discussing that with the governor, that would basically mean today, that he would have to tell New Orleans you need a mandatory evacuation. Well, we don't even know the forecasted path once it, gets past Cuba yet. And so you start narrowing that window down as best you can, but then when there's only maybe 48, 72 hours to evacuate, you're doing, especially for a place the size of Houston, you're doing more harm than good, because you have to evacuate all your nursing homes. You have to evacuate every individual that can evacuate is going to be on the streets. then you have to take care of everybody that cannot evacuate on their own. And so it's unrealistic to think that that can happen in a 48-hour period without there being some, you know, consequences.
So the reason – when you said 120 hours, I was thinking, wait a minute, that's like a week. Right?
Yeah, right. That's the –
you know, or
– in order to truly get all the buses in and get everybody and whatever possessions you're allowing them to take out – and you include hospitals and nursing homes and all the folks that that don't have access to vehicles, everyone that utilizes public transportation, it's a really difficult decision to make to order these mandatory evacuations. And then it got brought up during yesterday's conference call that if you do it for Louisiana, a lot of folks are going to pay attention now. And whereas for Katrina, they may have hopped in their car and gone, they know that everything they left behind was lost. So they're going to take every car. They're going to pull their boat. They're going to pull their camper. They're going to take everything that they can out. So now you're putting twice, three times as much traffic on the roads as you would have, you know, before, which is what you want. But so, yeah, it's not a simple decision. It's not just, hey, getting on the radio and announcing everybody needs to evacuate. There's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah, it certainly seems like it. That had never occurred to me before that there would be the kind of warning effect where people would say, oh, well, we really have to. We have to protect all the art. We have to store, you know, there would be all kinds of stuff. And I think also people tend to think about evacuation. I know I do based on their own situation. So sure, grab the kids, the wife, the pets, hop in the car and head out. But not everybody has that kind of capability. As you point out, rest homes, people without transportation, people with physical issues, people who need meds, you know, and or yep. need a steady supply. So, yeah, it's very complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. And you brought up medicines. I mean, that's a huge piece. I mean, if you're at the end of your monthly medicine and you're waiting for it to either come in the mail or to be able to go and get it from the pharmacy, then you're going to wait that extra day or two to get it, and we have contraflow, which means, you know, there's going to be some roads that you would normally take to go to your sisters or your family or your friends that you're not going to be able to get there because we're directing everybody in certain ways. So it's a logistical nightmare, but it's one that, you know, you take the safety into consideration and you make your decision based on that.
What's the single factor you might be most worried about? So let's say Irma all of a sudden spins on, you know, her heel and aims straight for Lafayette and Vermilion Bay and Lafayette. So what are you most worried about?
Well, you know, you're always worried. At those times, I'm not really too parochial. It's not Lafayette. You know, I'm going to do what we need to do to make the Lafayette citizens as safe as possible, but it's all the folks that are in harm's way that you start to get concerned. You want to make sure that we're prepared not just for our own residents, but to take in folks that we can take in. But being south of Interstate 10, FEMA doesn't look at us as a real sheltering possibility unless it's an absolute necessity. And so, you know, you just want to warn residents. You want to make sure they understand the reality that's coming their way and then encourage them to you know, take precautions and then be able to, like we talked about earlier, be able to take care of those that don't have transportation and don't have the ability to put themselves out of harm's way.
You just mentioned drainage, mm-hmm. and there are a number of issues with regard to Lafayette that you know, need to be worked on, I think. If you're talking about Lafayette, what are you thinking about in terms of flooding and so on? Are we doing anything with the cleaning out the coulees or doing any of that kind of stuff to prepare for this water issue?
Yeah, so I've asked for the reports now, and we're going to start making that information available to the public on all the ditches and the coulees that have been cleaned. But it's over 600 miles of coulees. Great. And if you see the map, you start to understand the magnitude of our coulee system. And the reality is all of that drains into the Vermilion River. And so as well as the Vermilion is draining is how well the coulees are going to ultimately drain. And so the Vermilion is at about a 4-foot grade over 100 miles. So it's a long, skinny, basically flat lake. I mean, it does not really even have a current on its own for it to drain into the Vermilion Bay. So we pump water into it to give it a current so it doesn't become stagnant. And that's the Teche Vermilion Water District does that, pumps water out of the Atchafalaya River north of Opelousas or north of Krotz Springs and pushes that down into Bayou Teche and into Vermilion just so that there's a current. When we have a serious rain event and all of those coulees are dumping into the Vermilion River runs backwards. It runs north up into St. Martin Parish at a significant rate, much faster than the current, than its normal current. And so what happens then is it's a wall of water that's in the Vermilion and the coulees are just, you know, emptying into it but are unable to empty into it because they hit a wall of water that's higher than the flood stage. And so then the coulees start backing up. And once the coulees start backing up, the main, you know, the Ile de Conne, the Coulee Mean, those really big coulees that we all envision, but all the laterals that attach to those now start backing up. And you know, I've learned more about hydrology and drainage than I ever thought I would. But you begin to realize that ultimately we can send as much water as fast as possible to the Vermilion River. But until the Corps of Engineers is willing to help us with the Vermilion, we're always going to have a problem. We're a very low-lying area. The Vermilion's still listed as a navigable waterway, which means you got to get Corps permission to dredge or to do anything. And so we've been working with the Corps. We're working on getting that done. And even that, you know, you're not going to change the grade. You're not going to change the real current of the Vermilion. You can dig it a little bit deeper, and it'll hold more water the first couple times it rains, and then it'll hit its, you know, level again, and then that's where it's going to stay. But you know we can do better. We want to get as much cleaned out of the coulees and the ditches as possible so that at least we can say that's not the reason. That's not the reason that these areas are flooding, and so there's got to be some other reason. Because right now a lot of folks can point to it, well, this coulee hadn't been dug out in 30 years. And we want to be able to remove that from people's minds to say, look, we live in a low-lying area. We're never going to be able to fix it totally. But we've dug out the coulees. We've dug out the front yard ditches. And we've done those things that we know we can do and then address the big problems with drainage, which, you know, is a different conversation.
Real quickly, where are we at with the rebuilding from the flood last August? Are most people taking steps? I mean, are we stalled out? What's the story?
Yeah, most folks have taken the steps. They've received those that had the flood insurance have received the lion's share of the flood insurance proceeds, and so there's a lot of rebuilding going on. But there's a lot of homes that are still sitting there with folks trying to figure out, you know, what the next steps are and what's going to happen, because there were so many that didn't have flood insurance. And so the Restore task force that put the restore.org, I think, is the Restore Louisiana, restorela.org, to be able to go sign up to get some of the $1.6 billion that the federal government allocated to us. You know, those checks are now being written. So we are encouraging people, make sure to go sign up, because ultimately, if you don't sign up, you have no shot at getting any of that money. And right now it's limited to those that didn't have insurance. But, you know, my suspicion is that the pool of eligible folks is going to grow. So whether you had insurance, didn't have insurance, no matter if your damage was great or small, there's a reimbursement component, even if you've already fixed your house. But you did it with your retirement and your savings account, or your family lent you some money to do it. Go apply, and that's what it's there for, is to try to make people as close to whole as possible.
One of the things that seems like such a tragedy is that, you know, folks have to make those decisions. They live in a house or in an area that's prone to flood. They didn't have flood insurance. Or they did have flood insurance. Even if they did, they got some sort of settlement. But then they have to decide, do I want to build back? What's my structure worth? How much money should I put in? Will I flood again at the very next occurrence? So all those are such difficult questions. And I know everybody knows somebody who is across Lafayette who is dealing with those kinds of issues. We're talking today with City Parish Mayor President Joel Robideau. And we're going to take a short break. And we're going to come right back and talk some more.
Has listening to KRVS become a part of your life? Are there times and places that you associate with listening? Moments of refuge where listening to the credible news and the beauty of music simply make your life better? If so, please consider supporting that quality programming by including KRVS in your retirement plan or will. You'll help keep the airwaves full of great music and culture well into the future. For more information, go online to krvs.org or talk with your financial advisor. And thank you for your support.
I want to see you at high noon. Noontime, Thursdays on KRVS 88.7. For rock, roll, rhythm, it's Old Gold on KRVS, an hour on Thursdays at noontime. Isley Kleinpeter with an invite to join me Thursdays at noon on KRVS 88.7 for Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Elvis, Carl Perkins, even Dolly Parton.
Welcome back to Bayou de Beltway. I'm chatting today with Lafayette Consolidated Government Mayor President Joel Robidoux. And we've been talking about floods and drainage and all those issues, but let's move on to – I would say let's move on to happier news, but I don't think this is it. Seems like much of the recent economic news for Lafayette is bad. The oil economy is still very down. Companies are still going in their third and fourth rounds of cuts. And then distressingly, as the economy is not so great, voters have rejected revenue measures for Lafayette Parish schools and even tax renewals to keep things as they were, the funding critical services, the jail, and the courthouse. So what's the city parish plan for dealing with this, in some ways, shocking failure to pass these sort of basic supports taxes?
Yeah, so I believe that an informed public will make the right decisions. And so I'll take, you know, the blame for the renewal failure because I don't feel like I did a good job of informing the public of why we need those and what that money is used for and why we can't afford for them to go away. And so, you know, those are mandated expenditures that by law. The state requires us to have a courthouse. The state requires us to have a jail, which makes sense. The parish general fund budget, the money that I have available to pay judges and DAs, parish employees for drainage crews, road crews, for the parish of Lafayette. This is not about the city. It's a different animal. But for the parish, is only about $12.2 million. That gets eaten up with the registrar of voters. Like I said, the DAs, the judges, the coroner's office, that gets eaten up pretty quick to run those things. And then the roads and the drainage. And so that $12 million disappears pretty quick. And it was only maybe 3-4 years ago that it was up around $15, $16 million. And so with the oil and gas crash, it's down to around the 12.2. Well, the jail and the courthouse, fortunately, voters said, look, we know we have to have the jail and the courthouse, so we'll put a separate millage to fund those things so you don't have to pay for it out of the $12 million that you have to pay for all those other things that are also mandated by the state of Louisiana. Well, those two millages total up to about $10 million, you know, $5-point-something million for one of them and $4-point-something million for the other. So if those millages don't exist, I have to pay for those out of the $12 million, which you can see leaves $2 million for the DA's office. So that means all of those things are going to be affected in a negative way. There's the things that I mentioned that aren't required by state law, roads and drainage, parish-wide fire protection, those things would go away. And we would then reduce the amount that we paid to run the DA's office, the court system, the jail, the clerk of court's office, and all those other things that I had mentioned. So really the failure of those two millages is not an option because it accounts for almost all of the general fund. It would all go towards operating the jail and the courthouse. So I think once the voters know that, I think they'll respond positively. You know, if you look at the turnout of that election, it was disappointingly low. I'm not sure how to change that, but when basically 6% of the adult population is you know, who voted to not renew those millages. And we need to do a better job of informing the voters, making sure that they know how important it is, and then getting them out to vote.
When you were elected, you talked about reaching out to communities outside Lafayette and making connections. Yet those seem to be the communities that are most resistant to taxes, tax renewals, and those sorts of things. Is your message getting out? Have you been successful in reaching out to those communities?
Yeah, I think we've really done a good job of reestablishing some relationships there. The vote that occurred, you know, had the school board tax attached to the ballot with it. And I think what happened is that drove out a lot of folks in the area where the new schools were. I think the Youngsville area was the area that voted against the renewals and for the school board millage at the highest levels. I mean, the city of Lafayette actually passed renewals. And so and those renewals lost by maybe 600 votes. So it was very close. It was 50-point-something to 49-point-something if you looked at the statistics. So it wasn't an overwhelming majority that an overwhelming majority wasn't what caused it to fail. So those outlying areas, I think the way that the school board tax and the sentiment to kill that initiative certainly carried over, and it was just easier for a lot of folks to do the no for all three. But we'll do a much better job of engaging with the voters and making sure that they understand the situation as it relates to the renewals.
Well, apparently anything to do with education is the kiss of death, so certainly separating it from anything with education. In a strongly anti-tax environment, how do you sell the message that government needs more money? Their trust in government is low. A lot of people think that government is corrupt and there's so much bad press about government. How do you tell people, no, look, we really need some money?
Yeah, and let me back up just a little bit and say that, you know, as Lafayette has grown, property taxes have risen, and so Lafayette does get, you know, additional revenue every you know, so often when those assessments are done, and so we're the beneficiary of that. Government is certainly, and so it's like, yeah, when these things come online and these new neighborhoods and these new businesses, there's this bump up in property tax collections that helps to build those roads.
We should note that doesn't increase the current people's property tax, right? That just brings on new people who are now paying property
tax. That's
right.
And so new folks are coming in, and so that's great. I mean, that's what you want out of your communities. You want it to be a place where folks want to live and businesses want to locate, and all that goes well. The problem is for Lafayette in particular is if you look at the last 4 years, any increases that have been realized in property taxes has been more than offset by the decline in sales taxes, because then that's related to the oil field industry and the layoffs and the number of businesses that have closed. And so while on the one hand you would say, hey, we've got all these businesses that have opened, there's this new property tax that's out there, we've lost more than that in sales tax. And so that's why the parish budget general fund went from 16 to 12. You know, it's if it wasn't for the property tax increases, that it would have been more drastic than that, because the sales tax declined even more. So it's real. I mean, we're suffering and we're making do with what we have, but we can't afford to lose what we have.
Your training as a CPA probably helps you understand all these issues, right?
Yeah, it makes it a little bit easier to dive into the books and see, you know, where we're doing well and where we're not doing so well. And that's one of the pieces that we're going to go to the public with as it relates to the drainage and this whole CREATE initiative, and realizing that we need to continue to diversify the economy away from oil and gas. And you know, whatever we can do in conjunction with oil and gas is great, but we can't be beholden to the ups and downs of the oil and gas industry. And we have this incredibly stable, vibrant economy that exists, you know, that I refer to as the cultural economy, and it's operated in silos. And if it, you know, it's a few individuals and a few businesses or organizations that have promoted it, but we've never approached it with this common purpose to say, no, we're going to capitalize on this in a very strategic way, and be smart about it, and put ourselves in a position where that's going to become the base of our economy. And then oil and gas will be lagniappe. And when it's up, it'll be great. And when it's down, we'll be able to survive, because this cultural economy – that we all of us, you know, kind of identify with anyway, that'll kind of carry us through the difficult times.
Now, a cultural economy, just to shake that out a little bit, might mean recreation, entertainment, arts, things connected with Cajun culture, Acadiana history,
Creole,
any of that stuff, music and all. So the idea is, if I understand it, is that you build on that and sell that, market that, and then that creates economic opportunities.
Yeah, and the example I use is, you know, Nashville decided they were going to be the country music capital of the world. And they really just made that up. And they became it, though, because they put forth a strategy that their government did to say, no, we're going to make ourselves attractive, and we're going to provide country musicians with, you know, they had the Grand Ole Opry, but that was really that and a couple other venues, but that was it. But they put in a strategy, and you look 30 years later and see what it's done for that city. It's been amazing. I mean, it is clearly a difference maker for those guys. We're not making it up. I mean, we really have Cajun Creole, Zydeco, Cajun music. We have all these things, and we've, you know, organically done a pretty good job of branding ourselves that way. But it has never been the focus of our economy, in my opinion, like it should be, because the return on investment for those types of things is so much higher than any other return on investment. And so any money that we're able to put into a strategic campaign is going to pay off and provide us with more sales tax and more property taxes and more businesses that want to locate here and more individuals that want to move here.
Sometimes I hear people say that they want us, that they want Lafayette City, but City Parish and so on, to be kind of the new Austin, you know. And that's, so there's some cultural elements there, but there are also governments there. There's a university there. Of course, there's a university here. There's also high tech. So is the city reaching out in terms of the high tech, trying to build off the fiber initiative?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a perfect example of and I include all that in the culture. I mean, we're one of the founding smart cities, you know, ahead of Austin. I mean, we were one of the first three that the U.S. government recognized as a gig city. And so we have all these components that when you put it together, you know, we have the ability to grow in a strategic way that's going to be long-lasting and stable, and ultimately is going to give us more money for drainage and more money to improve our roads and our traffic. And that's the direction we need to go.
Are you having people that are partnering with you on this that think it's a great idea, or are you finding some resistance, people that are worried about our region's going to lose its character?
Yeah, well, there's always both of those things. You have some resistance, but overall, you know, you have to trust in what you believe in, and I feel like this is going to economically take care of a lot of our problems. And so the university's been a great partner. The folks that have been in the cultural economy have been great partners, and they're thrilled to see us focusing on this because it's such a natural evolution of our economy.
One last thing. You have a weekly call-in radio show on 103.7 called The Sport of Politics. How's that been going? You like it?
Oh, yeah. It's fun. I enjoy it. You know, we talk about everything from national to local, and then national politics, state politics, local politics, all different, very different. I mean, local is where, you know, you can stop your councilman or me in the grocery store and say, hey, we need you to think about doing this. So I enjoy it. It's been great.
Certainly applaud you for getting out there and letting your constituents know what's up with you and what's up with the city. We have been talking today with City Parish Mayor President Joel Robideau. Thanks for joining us on
Bayou
Development.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Bayou de Beltway is copyrighted by KRVS for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without written consent of KRVS is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRVS, its officers, and members.
On the next Radiolab.
Music.
But no, not that kind of music!
We're talking about music that can knock your walls off.
Tweak your limits.
Save your life.
And steal your soul.
Yeah.
So deep down in the ground.
The power of music.
On the next Radiolab.
Coming up tonight at 9 on KRVS.
This is Public Radio for Acadiana. KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.